Due to the graphic nature of these crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of domestic violence that may be upsetting for some listeners. We advise extreme caution for children under the age of 13. For more information and resources, victims and survivors of domestic violence can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233 or visit www.thehotline.org. Twenty-seven-year-old Linda Edelman was just about to go to bed when she heard the doorbell ring. She was surprised. It was past time for visitors. Her surprise turned to shock when she opened the front door to find two police officers standing on the stoop. They told her they had come to arrest her husband, 28-year-old Robert, for making threatening phone calls to one of his clients. Robert seemed calm as the police led him away. He knew he had plenty of money to make bail and influential friends to make any legal troubles go away. He smiled at Linda from the back of the police car, as if the whole thing were a joke. But Linda wasn't laughing. This wasn't the first time her husband's combative nature had gotten him into trouble, and she knew it wouldn't be the last. She bit her lip as she walked back inside and shut the door. Nothing was ever enough for Robert. He had to control everything. He looked like an idiot, picking fights with everyone who crossed him. But what worried Linda most was that she looked like an idiot too, staying with him. Why did he have to be so childish and petulant? She sighed and leaned against the door. She knew better than anybody that he wasn't going to change. It had taken a long time for those bruises to heal. She started to imagine a different life for herself and her children, one free of late-night visits from the police and constant fear that Robert would blow up at them. The more she thought about it, the more real the dream became. If Robert wouldn't change, maybe she could. Hi, I'm Lainey Hobbs, and this is Crimes of Passion, a Parcast original. The legal definition of a crime of passion is a violent crime that occurs in the throes of extreme emotion, leaving no time to reflect on the consequences. But in this show, we explore how passionate relationships sometimes lead us to criminal activity. How does a husband and wife become killer and victim, or killer and co-conspirator? If there's a thin line between love and hate, what manipulates our relationships into deadly results? You can find episodes of Crimes of Passion and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Crimes of Passion for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Crimes of Passion in the search bar. At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. This week, we're covering Dallas real estate tycoon Robert Edelman and his wife, Linda. Robert rose to prominence during the city's economic boom in the 1980s, using his domineering and ruthless personality to get ahead. But these same attributes made him a nightmare to live with. He was a controlling tyrant towards Linda and their children. By 1986, after more than 15 years together, the Edelmans' marriage was fractured beyond repair. Next week, we'll delve into how the conflict between the Edelmans eventually led to a criminal investigation, an FBI sting, and federal charges. From an early age, Linda De Silva was a romantic. She grew up obsessed with Disney movies and dreamed of voicing a Disney princess. She was entranced by the idea of living out a fairy tale life, complete with a Prince Charming. In the late 1960s, when Linda was a young college student at the University of Oklahoma, she enjoyed performing on stage in musicals, the kind of shows that almost always ended with the boy getting the girl. It was in college that 21-year-old Linda met 22-year-old Robert Edelman. Linda immediately realized they had little in common. She was outgoing and vivacious, while Robert was quiet and brooding. But when he started to open up to her, Linda decided their differences were romantic. They began dating in the summer of 1967. Robert wasn't the only boy Linda was seeing, but he was far more persistent than any of her other suitors. He always made an effort for her, bringing her flowers when she performed and doing his best to take an interest in the things she liked. Best of all, he was attentive. When Linda went on tour for a university musical, Robert called her every night to tell her how much he missed her. Linda was won over by Robert's commitment. After only a few months, he proposed, and Linda accepted. In June of 1968, Robert and Linda got married in Duncan, Oklahoma. Soon after, they moved to Robert's hometown of Dallas. Everything fell into place at first. Robert took a sales job with Honeywell Computers, while Linda began working with Dallas Summer Musicals, a local theater company. But it didn't take long for Robert and Linda to become restless. When Robert was offered a transfer to New York City after just a few months at his job, Linda excitedly told him to take it. She wanted to pursue a career on Broadway, and the transfer would give him the opportunity to make more money. The couple eagerly left for New York that fall. But the move did not go smoothly. Robert hoped they'd be able to live in a swanky Manhattan apartment with a doorman, but the buildings they admired were out of their budget. Instead, they moved into a one-bedroom in Queens. Robert refused to endure the long subway ride downtown, so Linda drove him to and from work each day. Robert enjoyed his work, but he frequently complained about how expensive the city was and how they were forced to live so modestly. He wanted people to see him as important and successful. Living in a cramped apartment in Queens made him feel insignificant. As a result, he became increasingly moody and petulant. Before I continue with Robert's psychology, please note, I am not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but I have done a lot of research for the show. Robert's obsession with money and status symbols demonstrated his high level of ambition, but it may have also been a bad sign for his marriage. In a 2011 study conducted by Brigham Young University and William Patterson University, researchers found that people who place a high priority on making money are less likely to be in satisfying and stable marriages. Professor Jason Carroll, a lead author of the study, found that materialism was linked to less effective communication and higher levels of negative conflict. The researchers speculated that the participants' lower level of marital satisfaction wasn't necessarily caused by the materialism itself, but could be due to the personality traits associated with materialism. According to clinical psychologist Susan Heitler, people who are materialistic tend to be narcissistic and concerned with impressing people. These qualities, in turn, can cause marital problems. Robert constantly griped to Linda about how much he hated the city. Linda couldn't seem to improve his mood, but she did her best to try to support him. Her social life had always revolved around other performers and actors, but in New York, she rarely spent time with theater friends. Instead, she spent most evenings with Robert and his Honeywell colleagues. She continued to drive him to and from work each day and tried to remain upbeat to avoid setting him off. Sometimes he exploded anyway, yelling and screaming at her until she burst into tears. But that wasn't the only reason life in New York City was difficult for Linda. After the move, her Broadway career didn't take off as she'd hoped. She went on plenty of auditions, but failed to book many jobs. She was also terribly homesick. She had lived almost her entire life in the Southwest, never very far from family. New York was a world away from anything familiar. She tried her best to be positive, but over the next few years, it became more and more difficult. Robert was desperate to succeed, and when he continued to suffer setbacks, he took out his frustration on his wife. Linda sighed as she dropped her car keys on the coffee table. Robert shrugged past her and switched on the TV. She was about to join him on the couch when the phone rang. It was her mother. The family was finally coming to visit. Linda practically screamed for joy. She was so excited. It would be a few weeks until they arrived, but she finally had a bright spot to look forward to after so many months of gloominess. She turned to Robert and eagerly shared the news. She hoped he'd at least smile. She knew he didn't really care about her family. He barely knew them, but he might at least pretend. She enthusiastically told him her parents and sister would be coming to visit soon. As she spoke, Robert's jaw tensed and his eyes bulged. His face darkened until it was an angry shade of red. Linda realized then that he was furious. She was about to ask him why he was so upset when he suddenly moved toward her. His fist flew out and she fell backward, slamming against the wall. Pain bloomed along the side of her face. Linda's heart raced and tears sprang to her eyes. A moment later, Robert was by her side, apologizing and telling her that he didn't know what had come over him, but she barely registered what he was saying. All she could think about was the expression on his face right before he hit her. She knew he was irritable, but this was the first time he had taken things this far. Robert helped her to her feet. He was still trying to placate her and tell her that everything would be all right, but she knew it wasn't true. There was something terribly wrong in their marriage. They needed a drastic change if anything was going to get better. She wanted so badly to believe he was sorry, but in the back of her mind, she worried it was only a matter of time until it happened again. It terrified her. By the early 1970s, 24-year-old Linda and 25-year-old Robert decided that they needed to get out of New York. Robert proposed moving back to Dallas. He figured that at the very least, their financial situation would improve. Linda agreed, and the couple moved back to Texas. Robert returned to the Dallas Honeywell office, and Linda went back to performing with the Dallas Summer Musicals group. They tried to forget about their unhappy stint on the East Coast. It was easier for Robert, who had a knack for recognizing lucrative business prospects. He quickly realized that the return to Texas wasn't a failure, but an exciting professional opportunity. In the 1970s, the Texas economy was thriving due to the rising oil prices. Between 1967 and 1975, profits soared, contributing to job growth and drawing almost 2 million new residents. Robert recognized the need for more housing to accommodate the exploding population and the opportunity to make his fortune. He was obsessed with the idea of becoming rich and powerful. He spoke often about his dream of owning a luxurious house in University Park, one of the wealthiest areas of Dallas. But he didn't yet have the assets he needed to achieve this goal. His first move was to secure a loan and use it to found the Good Earth Development Company. Thus began a new career as a real estate developer. Robert had a gift for understanding what new homebuyers were looking for. He thrived in his new profession and was generally calmer at home than he had been in New York. Linda was pleased her husband had found his calling, even if success brought out new unpleasant traits. Many of his associates found him to be brash and arrogant. He was braggadocious and obnoxious around Linda, too, but it was still an improvement over the wallowing resentment he displayed in New York, so she did her best to ignore it. After all, she too was enjoying success in the new city. Even if it wasn't Broadway, she still got to do what she loved, performing with the Dallas Summer Musicals. When she wasn't on stage, she helped Robert grow his business, acting as the company's point of contact with homebuyers and subcontractors. These individuals preferred to deal with her, as many found Robert's pushy attitude off-putting. Linda was happy to step in to help the Good Earth Development Company flourish. Though things were far from perfect, for the first time in their relationship, they were prosperous and comfortable. They began to think about starting a family. Linda even converted to Judaism so that their future children could be raised with one faith. Robert was thrilled. But Linda soon discovered wealth and privilege only temporarily dampened Robert's fury. He was still constantly on the verge of blowing up. When we return, we'll talk about how Robert's controlling behavior over Linda escalated until her marriage became a prison from which she was desperate to escape. Now, back to the story. In 1973, 28-year-old Robert Edelman was making a name for himself as a Dallas real estate developer with his 27-year-old wife, Linda, by his side. Business was booming, but Robert wasn't making any friends along the way. Making money always came first, no matter the consequences. He developed a habit of failing to pay his subcontractors on time, if at all. He knew that for many of the smaller companies he did business with, it would be too costly for them to hire lawyers to take him to court, so they had no recourse if he failed to pay. He didn't care whether he was known for being unscrupulous or belligerent, as long as profits surged. He often became combative with prospective homebuyers over minor disagreements when constructing a new home. He pushed back if the buyer wanted to modify small things like the light fixtures or door handles. He refused to change anything that would cost him slightly more money. He took arguments as personal attacks and always escalated the situation. As he became more successful, Robert behaved more and more like a narcissist. Mental health counselor Stephanie Sarkis described narcissists as people who readily enforce rules on other people while behaving as if the rules don't apply to them. She further stated that a narcissist cannot tolerate someone who rejects them and whom they feel is disloyal, even if the rejection is merited. When a narcissist feels betrayed, they are quick to seek revenge. According to one account, Robert Edelman targeted problem clients with harassing phone calls until they retracted their complaints or requests. Robert's need to avenge petty slights quickly became a problem for his business. In 1973, he was arrested for making these threatening calls, although his target ultimately decided not to press charges. Linda begged him to stop this behavior, but he told her to shut up and mind her own business. Linda realized that Robert would not tolerate any criticism from her. To keep the peace, she had to remain completely supportive of her husband, whether he was right or wrong. Eventually, Robert's hostile tactics hurt his reputation, but rather than adjust his attitude, he simply changed his business. In 1978, 34-year-old Robert moved away from residential development and into commercial real estate, a sector of the industry where he had less enemies and could form new alliances. He recruited a business partner named David W. Tompkins, A local paper described Tompkins as the face man who comes in and smooths over the deals after Robert has made everyone furious. The timing was perfect as Linda was pregnant and didn't have much time to devote to Robert's career. David took over many of her duties as the company's charming spokesperson. Stephen Edelman was born in 1979. 2 years later, they welcomed a daughter, Kathleen. As Linda focused her attention on motherhood, she took a step back from Robert's business dealings. Why worry? As far as she could tell, business was booming. But in reality, Robert was struggling. His first commercial project was a condominium called the Embassy Tower. He had high hopes for the development, but his antagonistic nature immediately got in the way. He incited several arguments with the city because the apartment didn't meet safety and fire codes. He reportedly badgered inspectors until they were so fed up, they refused to certify the building was up to code. Without a certificate of occupancy, Robert couldn't legally rent out units, and the building remained vacant for years. Robert's next project, a set of offices on Maple Avenue, called the Cedar Maple Plaza, was a little more successful. However, even though the media praised the style and aesthetics of the new complex, Robert had trouble securing tenants due to the high rent. The project was still underway when Robert decided he was tired of waiting to live how he wanted. As always, he dealt with stress at his job by looking for validation through material wealth. Though money was tight, Robert started making preparations to move to University Park, an affluent enclave bordering Dallas City proper. He and Linda purchased a lot on Carruth Boulevard, one of the most desirable locations in the city, and Robert built a 7,300 square foot mansion. In 1984, Robert, Linda, and their children, 4-year-old Stephen and 2-year-old Kathleen, moved into their sprawling new home. They quickly went to work filling the rooms with pricey furniture and antiques. Linda tried to enjoy the new home, but she noticed that Robert was increasingly strained. In the 1980s, Texas's economic boom ebbed. Oil prices dropped, cutting the state's revenue by 20%. With the region's most profitable industry in decline, other markets began to suffer as well. Robert's business took a hit, and so did his ego. In a study conducted by the National Center to End Domestic Violence, researchers discovered that economic hardships can often exacerbate domestic violence. Citing the study, Rebecca White, the president and CEO of the Houston Area Women's Center, said that domestic violence is 3 times more likely to occur when couples experience high levels of financial strain. She added, economic stress does not cause domestic violence, but a bad economy does make a bad situation worse. When Robert's business prospects suffered, so did his family. He grew enraged at any provocation. He snapped at his 5-year-old son when the boy wanted to play softball instead of soccer. He ridiculed Linda when he thought the furniture she chose for their new house looked tacky. He grew resentful when Linda took trips with the children to visit her family. Every time they vacationed in Oklahoma, he called them relentlessly, multiple times a day, wanting to know every detail of Linda's itinerary and the precise moment she and the children would be home. But by far, the couple's most bitter point of contention was religion. Linda had converted to Judaism, but ultimately felt uncomfortable with the change. After a few years, she decided she wanted to bring the children to a Baptist church. The couple sought marriage counseling to alleviate the dispute, but nothing could reconcile their difference in opinion. As their relationship faltered, Robert's temper worsened. Linda later described how he started berating her at the slightest provocation. He screamed in her face that she was worthless, a bad mother, and a disappointment as a wife. On one occasion, he lost his temper when she refused to accompany him to an important business lunch. According to Linda, he threw her down on the bed and choked her until she nearly passed out. The incident left her traumatized. When her housekeeper, Rosilla, saw her bruises, she warned Linda, "That man will kill you." For the first time in a while, Linda re-examined her marriage and decided enough was enough. Linda paced up and down the hallway outside the bedroom, thinking about what she wanted to say to Robert. All these years, she had catered to his every need. In New York, she had driven him to and from work. When they moved back, she had helped him start an entirely new business. She had raised their children and protected them from their own father. All of it was over now. There was nothing he could say. She was going to take the children and visit her parents in Oklahoma. She would no longer bend over backwards to appease him. She suddenly realized she had been in denial for a long time. Nothing would ever be easy with Robert. He wanted to fight because he knew that with her, he'd always win. He was never happy unless he was beating some adversary in a battle. And Linda was his favorite opponent, but not anymore. Linda had reached her limit. That night, after Robert came home from work, Linda told him point blank that she was leaving with the kids and that she wouldn't be coming back. She expected him to get angry, but he didn't. Instead, he seemed close to tears. He pleaded with her to reconsider and to return to marriage counseling. But Linda refused. She told him that the arrangements had already been made. She and the children were getting on a plane to Oklahoma. They would not return to Dallas until Robert moved out of the house. In October of 1985, after 17 years of marriage, Linda filed for divorce, contending that Robert was cruel, harsh, and tyrannical, according to court records. As part of the divorce proceedings, the judge created a custody arrangement for the couple's children. He ordered that 6-year-old Stephen and 4-year-old Kathleen would remain in their University Park home on Carruth Boulevard full-time. Robert and Linda alternated their stays in the house. For 10 days, one parent lived at the house with the children, while the other stayed elsewhere. Then they swapped. The judge felt that this would disrupt the children's lives as little as possible. On days when he wasn't staying at the Carruth house, Robert lived at the family's old house on Pagewood Drive, which they never managed to sell. When Linda wasn't with the children, she checked into a Holiday Inn. Linda was deeply unhappy with the arrangement. She felt that moving out of her house every 10 days and living out of a suitcase in a hotel was too inconvenient to be sustainable. She also believed that Robert was snooping into her belongings on the days that he was staying at the home. He wasn't supposed to enter her bedroom, but he often did anyway, even installing listening devices to spy on Linda while he was away. Though he clearly wasn't over Linda, Robert started seeing a new woman in the hopes of making her jealous. He allowed his new girlfriend, 37-year-old Diana Key, to stay with him when he was living at the Carruth house. Linda hated having another woman staying at her home, and the arrangement severely confused the children. The trauma inflicted on the children by the new custody arrangement was by far the worst part. They had to watch their mother leave their home over and over again. 6-year-old Stephen's grades started to suffer at school, and 4-year-old Kathleen frequently woke up sobbing, unable to communicate what was wrong. The children were worn down by their parents' constant fighting. Custody exchanges often ended in screaming matches between Robert and Linda, sometimes in full view of the neighbors. They went to court to argue over the smallest, pettiest details. In one instance, their judge had to intervene to decide who would dress Kathleen and brush her hair for her dance recital. A court-appointed attorney assigned to look after the children's interests later said, "What these people were doing to the children was atrocious. They both loved the kids. There was no question about that. But I've never seen two people behave so misguidedly with their children." Eventually, the judge rescinded the prior custody arrangement. He hoped that a new plan would reduce the family stress and allow tensions to cool. Linda moved back into the Carruth house full-time, and Robert was granted visitation. Linda was pleased with the change, but she was still anxious about the upcoming divorce proceedings. After all, Robert was using one of the city's most prominent family law attorneys to represent him. Linda felt that her own lawyer wasn't aggressive enough to go up against them. Her friends warned her that the court system often favored rich and powerful men, like her husband. One of her neighbors told Linda she had to fight fire with fire. The neighbor had recently gone through a divorce herself and recommended the renowned lawyer, M.J. Ike, Van den Eickel. Linda fired her lawyer and borrowed money from her parents to pay Ike's retainer. Ike was confident and persuasive, and with his help, Linda began to feel better about the direction of the proceedings. She knew that it might take years to divide the property and work on a custody agreement, but she thought the worst was over. She didn't realize this only intensified Robert's cutthroat attitude. She would soon learn just how far he was willing to go to beat her. When we return, Robert resolves to end his marriage his own way. Now, back to the story. In 1986, Dallas couple 41-year-old Robert and 40-year-old Linda Edelman were in the middle of a hellish divorce. To stand up to Robert's aggressive nature, Linda hired a new divorce attorney, Ike Van Eickel. She hoped that she and Robert would soon come to a resolution. But Robert felt threatened by Linda's impressive new attorney. He didn't want Linda to have any kind of edge over him and began looking for ways to thwart her. In October of 1986, Robert hired a private investigator named Colonel Joseph James Young. 63-year-old Colonel Young was locally recognized as a war hero, awarded with the Distinguished Service Cross, two Purple Hearts, and a Bronze Star. However, Young was likely lying about his military record. He was honorably discharged from the Army in 1946 and spent the next few decades working odd jobs around the country. The first record of him impersonating an officer was in 1965 at an Army Reserve group. Apparently, he lied about his history because he thought it would sound more impressive. It seemed that once he started fabricating details of his past, he couldn't stop. He created an incredibly convoluted history for himself. He maintained that he had worked as a special forces officer with intelligence groups on covert missions in Europe and Southeast Asia. He even said that he had served as a bodyguard to the Pope, though he never specified when, and there is no evidence any of this was true. Colonel Young was evidently a convincing imposter. Nobody questioned his ruse. He established himself as a pillar of the local military community, working with Army recruitment offices and speaking at local high schools. He built a network of ex-military and veteran friends and was known throughout Dallas for his distinguished record of service. Young began working as a private investigator in 1983, even though he never obtained the necessary license. He claimed to be an expert in providing surveillance and security services. When Robert Edelman came to him for help, he didn't know about Colonel Young's past. He only knew that Young had a reputation for getting things done. Robert later said that he secured the colonel's services to find out how Linda was spending her money and to determine whether she was dating anyone. Although Linda denied it, he claimed that the children made comments about a new boyfriend. In November of 1986, Young began tracking Linda's movements. He made regular reports to Robert about his findings. For a while, Robert seemed satisfied with Young's work, but in January of 1987, he wanted to make a change. Around that time, Robert invited Young over to his house. Young said that he seemed particularly on edge and guarded. He even strip-searched the private detective before allowing him inside to ensure Young wasn't wearing a wire. Then, Robert asked Young to take a walk. On that walk, Young said Robert outlined a new plan. He didn't want Young to merely spy on Linda. He offered Young $45,000, the equivalent of around $101,000 today, to kill her. Young held himself out to be a tough, trained killer. He might have accepted the hit to protect his reputation, but he wasn't in any rush to actually carry it out. After accepting the job in early 1987, Young spent the next 6 months spying on Linda, trying to learn as much as he could about her habits. Linda did not realize she was being followed. In fact, she was feeling optimistic. As they tried to come to a settlement on custody and the split of property, Robert suddenly seemed much more cooperative. In June of 1987, Linda wanted to take the kids to Disney World with her parents. She expected Robert to object and try to keep the kids in Dallas, but he let them go without an argument. Linda left her lawyer's office feeling almost giddy. At last, the children had settled into a stable routine now that she and Robert had finally worked out a temporary visitation agreement. Linda didn't know what had caused the change in Robert's attitude, but it seemed that he had finally learned that there were rules to follow. He liked to think that he was above the law, but now the courts, the judge, and the lawyers were all there to make sure he couldn't bully the family. It was a wonderful relief to know that they were on equal footing. The date to their final custody hearing was looming closer, and Linda found that she was looking forward to it instead of dreading it. Once it was over, everything would settle down. She could relax and finally start thinking about her future. By midsummer of 1987, Colonel Young had been following 41-year-old Linda for half the year. He followed her to the grocery store. He followed her to the hair salon. He followed her when she went to pick up her kids from school. When she went to Disney World with her children and family, Young even followed her to Florida. According to Young, Robert instructed him to kill Linda while she was at Disney World, but Young couldn't do it. The place was too crowded for him to keep track of her. After Linda returned home to Dallas safely, Robert grew restless. He started to suspect Young would never get the job done. He decided to give the supposed war hero one last chance. He met Colonel Young at a restaurant near the private investigator's office, armed with blueprints of Linda's house. He meticulously went over the home's layout with Young and explained to him how he could break in. The latest plan was to take place when it was Robert's turn with the children. With Linda alone in the house, he told Young to enter through the garage and kill her in the night. He told Young to make it look like a robbery gone bad, and even asked him to steal a few pieces of jewelry to further the facade. Young assured him that this time, he would get the job done. Despite these assurances, Young was getting cold feet. It may be that he was not as adept at killing as he pretended to be. Forensic psychologist Reed Malloy has said that nearly every contract killer he studied displayed traits of moderate to severe psychopathy. He explained that this psychopathy gives them both the aggression and the emotional detachment to be able to carry out an act like this for money. Colonel Young was a liar and a fraud, but there's no evidence he was violent. he wasn't an expert in carrying out murders, and he later said that he never really wanted to go through with it. Perhaps he realized that he didn't fit the mold of a calculating killer. It may seem extreme for someone like Young to take on a contract killing just to maintain his reputation, but saving face can be a powerful motivator. In a line of work like Young's, a good reputation was essential for business. But as Dr. Alex Slickerman points out, how others think of us is often directly tied to our own self-esteem. He writes, "Many find their sense of value vulnerable to the opinions of others, especially their perception of the collective opinions of others." Young wasn't all he was cracked up to be, but he still had plenty of close contacts who actually possessed the credentials he only pretended to have. Since he wasn't able to carry out the hit himself, he decided to subcontract the job out to a friend who might be better equipped to handle a killing. For years, Young had been acquainted with a man named Fred Sabatowski. The two men often met at various functions hosted by the Special Forces Association in Dallas. 45-year-old Sabatowski had a troubled youth. He had spent time in reform school after facing charges for petty theft and vandalism as a teen. But he joined the Army in 1959, served in the 5th Special Forces Group, and was later awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions during the Vietnam War. Colonel Young reached out to Sabatowski and asked him if he wanted to earn some money by taking a murder-for-hire job. Sabatowski quickly responded that he was interested and he wanted to hear more. Meanwhile, Linda Edelman carried on her life as usual, with no idea that two men she had never met were busy plotting her death. But soon, things would come to a head in the most terrifying way possible. Thanks again for tuning into Crimes of Passion. We will be back Wednesday with part two of Linda and Robert Edelman's story. We'll discuss how Robert amped up the pressure on his hired hitman and what happened when Colonel Young put his plan into action. You can find more episodes of Crimes of Passion and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Crimes of Passion, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Crimes of Passion on Spotify, just open the app and type Crimes of Passion in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time when true love meets true crime. Crimes of Passion was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, with sound design by Trent Williamson, production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Carly Madden. This episode of Crimes of Passion is written by Christina Pammies. I'm Lainey Hobbs.